Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
The essence of the appeal is that a certain conversation that occurred between two of the witnesses that was recorded by the Irish prison system, the court weren't made aware of that. That is John Dunedin's appeal. And in part, some of the explanation for that is that it fell between the cracks because he had fired his own legal team shortly before the case began.
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you're listening to Crime World, a podcast about criminals, drugs and the sins of the underworld in Ireland and across the globe. Killer John Dunedin is appealing his conviction for the murder of innocent rugby player Shane Gagan in Limerick more than 10 years ago. Today, I'm talking with Niall Donald about the attempts by the violent Dunedin brother to convince judges he's been wrongly convicted and to win back his freedom. This is Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com.
Have you hit okay, Niall?
That says leave meeting, so, or does it say?
No, it says okay. Jason, please leave this in at the beginning of it, because Smart Arse has just made an announcement that I have made technical announcements in relation to Zoom recording that we're doing. You first of all said, like, as if, what would I know? And then you're going to hit leave meeting instead of okay to the recording.
Well, do you know what actually sprang to mind there as you started to speak? It reminded me of Alan Partridge and his autobiography, which every chapter ended, and I showed them I was right in the end, or something along that. So I thought that's what sprang to mind there, Nicola. You had to get I was right into your...
Just a very odd time when I do get something correct around, like, laptops or computers or anything. I do need to sing that from the rooftops.
You do like that to be broadcast where many listen. Okay, I'll give you that one. Well done.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Anyway, we're not here to talk about that or to bicker. That sounds like we're having a little bicker, doesn't it? Like one of those sort of people, you know, these couples that go away on holidays together and they've spent so much time in each other's company, they just bicker.
Well, speaking of bickering, what a segue into the Dunedin and the Collins family.
That's exactly what I was thinking. But yes, it is actually, isn't it? Because... what I wanted to ask you was, have you any idea why this appeal has taken so long? We're going to talk about John Dunedin's appealing his conviction for the murder of the innocent rugby player Shane Gagan. 2013 that happened, yeah?
2013,
or was that the conviction date? So we're 11 years on and the appeal is only coming up now, or is this a second or third appeal?
I'm actually not sure. I don't know why these things can take so long. You know, he's obviously had a lot of problems with his legal representation over the years. He's fired a number of solicitors. Fired is probably the wrong word. He's parted ways with them, let's put it that way. I'd imagine he's an awkward character to deal with, but I don't know. And the wheels of justice can grind very, very slowly on some occasions. It does seem a remarkable amount of time. He has had difficulties in the prison system and all of that, but I don't know why it is. But I remember I was in court a few of the days. I don't know if you ever went down.
I did.
And certainly the build-up to some of those cases was very chaotic. he went on an extended hunger strike, actually, at one stage. A lot of the picture just before one of the trials, you can see him often looking quite chunky in the court images that we have of him, but he was very, very slimmed down by the time it did get to court. And of course, he parted ways with his legal team just before the case was about to start. And that actually features in this appeal, because the essence of the appeal is that a certain conversation that occurred between two of the witnesses that was recorded by the Irish prison system, the court weren't made aware of that. That is John Dundon's appeal. And in part, some of the explanation for that is that it fell between the cracks because he had fired his own legal team shortly before the case began.
So now, the characters involved in all this are largely the Dundon and the Collins and the McCarthy families. So the Dundons, who we all know were family of brothers who returned to Limerick sometime just coming up to the new millennium. And they returned when a feud was already sort of bubbling with their cousins, the McCarthys, against the Keams. And they sort of gave the backing to the McCarthys, which made them a very powerful force. And for the following 10 years, there was horrendous occurrences in Limerick as these gangs went to war, fighting almost for personal reasons as well as over drug turf, I think. And a notorious feud that only kind of came to an end when the resources, the full resources of the state were put on it. And as part of that full resources of the state, who, you know, were kind of practicing an almost tango style policing down there, they had ERU, etc. The pressure put on the gangs basically caused a divide, and a few state witnesses came forward, many of them from the Collins family. And the Collins family were neighbours of the Dundons on Hyde Road. They lived there. The father would have been a member of the McCarthy Dundon gang, as was one of the brothers. But the girls, Lisa Collins and her sister April Collins, were kind of in relationships with some of the McCarthy Dundons. In particular, April Collins had a number of kids with and was having a long-term relationship with Ger Dundon. So when it kind of emerged that she was going to give evidence against the Dundons, it was quite extraordinary at the time. She was a state witness and in protection, but while she moved out of the area for a short while, she moved straight back in, and there was a chaotic situation where the police had to protect her on the same road that the guys pretty much who didn't want her to give evidence were living on. But she's a bolshy tough woman, and she seemed to manage to survive. She had a new relationship, which we've spoken about before as well. Now, it was Lisa Collins and Christopher McCarthy that gave evidence at John Dundon's trial.
Yeah. So, I mean, three people really, there was three key witnesses. One of them was April Collins, and the second was her sister, Lisa Collins. So this is so involved, actually, when you start saying it. So it's her sister, yeah, Lisa Collins, who was gone out with Christopher McCarthy, who was a first cousin of the Dundon brothers. The other McCarthys that you're speaking about are probably second cousins of the Dundon brothers. Christopher McCarthy was one of the closest associates of the Dundon brothers. He was no angel, as he says himself, had a number of serious convictions, including firearms and car offences. And he was gone out with Lisa Collins. And he had also come back from London at a similar time. The Dundon's mother was Anne McCarthy, and she would have been Christopher McCarthy's aunt. So right. What happened really was that April Collins, Lisa Collins and Christopher McCarthy all gave evidence slightly before and slightly after the murder of Shane Gagan. And they all spoke about speaking to John Dundon directly in the aftermath and just slightly before. If you remember the case, which you will, Shane Gagan, who was a rugby player, no involvement in crime, no knowledge of any crime, just was living in an estate, was a kind of a burly enough rugby playing sort of guy, looked vaguely like a criminal who lived a few doors away from him, a guy called John Pitchfork McNamara, who was a key associate of the Keane Colopy gang. Pitchfork McNamara was his number one target. And John Dundon had set up him to be murdered. He sent Barry Doyle out, a hitman from Dublin. Barry Doyle stalked on this road, saw a guy looking vaguely like McNamara, and shot him dead. It was Shane Gagan, nothing to do with anything. So April Collins, when she started this new relationship with a gang rapist called Thomas O'Neill, the Dundon brothers didn't take that kindly. Jared Dundon was in prison at the time. He went ballistic in prison as well. And they started threatening the Collins family. And that ultimately led to this breakdown. And April Collins described in court how she had booked a hotel room in advance to give Jared Dundon an alibi, and that John Dundon had arrived. At a later point, she'd spoken to John Dundon, who was with Barry Doyle, and John Dundon was described as being very excited that he's saying that Johnny Mack was dead and that he was going to phone Philip Colopy and sort of brag about the murder, and that Barry Doyle was with him. And then at a later point, Lisa Collins also gave evidence, because the whole Collins family fell out with the Dundons, and she had described how John Dundon had forced her, according to the evidence she gave, her and Christopher McCarthy, her boyfriend, were told, you have to rob a car because we're going to kill the cunt, basically, is what he said about Johnny McNamara. How they had robbed the car in advance of the murder from a pub, given it to John Dundon, and that she had been told, if you don't rob it, I'm going to bash you, basically, and that they had eventually, after the murder, they realised it was the wrong man, and John Dundon was really upset.
Yeah, I'll just tell listeners a little bit about Barry Doyle, for what it's worth, the other character in this story, because he was the hitman, the gunman. He wasn't a prolific hitman like his brother, Paddy Doyle, who had worked, both of the Doyles came from the North Inner City, and Paddy Doyle had been a sort of personal hitman for Fat Freddy Thompson during the Crumlin Drimna feud. He was prolific, and at one point he was believed to be responsible for three murders that occurred within a very short space of time. That was in around 2000 and maybe six, at which point he fled to Spain and settled in to Spain to live out there, settled in pretty much to the heart of that growing Kinahan organisation. But it is believed that Barry Doyle was a bit of a, people would call him a bit of a head the ball, and he wasn't very respectful to Daniel Kinahan. Barry Doyle was in a Jeep with Freddie Thompson and Gary Hutch one day. The electricity had gone off at his house, and he had phoned them to come collect and to go to the gym, which they did. And while they were in that Jeep came under fire. Barry Doyle was shot dead, and Paddy Doyle was shot dead, and the other two fled.
Yeah.
Now, initially, the story that was kind of coming out of Spain and that was put out by the Kinahan organization was that Paddy Doyle had been killed by the Russians, that he owed money to the Russians. There was talk of a shipment going missing, of touting, all the rest of this. And Gary Hutch returned to Dublin to carry his coffin. By 2010, the Operation Shovel files were basically naming Paddy Doyle as a victim of the Kinahan organization. It had become apparent that his murder had been ordered by Daniel Kinahan. And that's why I just mentioned that he wasn't very respectful to him, bit of a head the ball. Was that enough maybe at that point to have sealed his fate? You know, it's all a bit murky, as these things always are. But when Doyle was murdered that time, his brother Barry, his younger brother, took it very badly. And he kind of had been, I think, on the straight and narrow largely up until that point. He sort of in his grieving process of grieving, I think he became quite paranoid, and he ended up taking refuge within the McCarthy Dundon gang in Limerick. And he was down with them and living amongst them and with them. And, you know, the story goes that they were pretty much feeding him drugs at that point, and he was pretty paranoid, but he had to sort of pay back that protection that he got and the drugs that he had taken. And that's why they sent him out as a hitman on that job.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, while Paddy Doyle was living over in Spain, one of the people who came over and spent an extended period of time with him was Jared Dundon, who actually lived with him for a while. So Paddy Doyle was particularly close to them. And after after his murder, the Dundons invited Barry Doyle, as I said, down to Limerick. But you can see in John Dundon's interaction with all of these people that he had around him. So Christopher McCarthy, in his evidence, described how John Dundon told him, you know, he threatened he would kill me if I didn't get this car. Doyle certainly was, you know, not getting, he was being put up by the Dunsans, but there was a payback, and that payback was that he had to commit this murder. So there was all of these fears and threats going on around the Dunsans. And so that's, I mean, that's the essence of the appeal, involves this, the fact that while Christopher McCarthy was in prison, and he spent a lot of time in prison, and by his own admission, he described himself, so I'm not saying I'm an angel, when he gave his evidence, I'm not saying I'm an angel, and he certainly isn't, but I'm telling the truth today. But while he was in prison, every, as you know yourself, prisoners are allowed phone calls all the time, official phone calls to their loved ones or whatever. But every single one of those phone calls is recorded. The prisoners know it. It's not a secret thing. It's just the way it is. And during one of these phone calls, Lisa Collins and Christopher McCarthy discussed what would happen to John Dunsan if he was convicted in relation to these offences as a result of what they were saying. And they had this discussion at the time, saying 10 years isn't enough for John Dunsan, basically. And this conversation, according to John Dunsan's appeal, is it implies that they may have had a motive. Because they were in fear of him, they may have had a motive to overstate his role in that murder, and that conversation should have been admitted to court, should have been discussed. And the counsel said the reference to Dunsan receiving 10 years for a particular offence, that, and them saying that wouldn't be sufficient. And he says that suggests that Mr. Collins and Ms. Collins and Mr. McCarthy had a motive to ensure that Dunsan was convicted of offence carrying a greater penalty, such as murder. And that if Dunsan's legal team at the time had known about the conversation, his barrister said they would undoubtedly have used it to undermine the credibility of Mr. McCarthy, Lisa Collins, and her sister, April Collins. So that is their contention.
And they're saying that this conversation has remained sort of hidden until now, that it was buried within the evidence, or that it certainly hadn't been discovered.
Well, what they're saying is it fell between the cracks. So this conversation was obviously made available to them under discovery. That as part of it, but it didn't get presented to court. So that it's a different type of thing, as if they haven't just uncovered.
As if they didn't. In other words, as if they didn't notice it before. But now they've sort of noticed it. They've seen it, and now it's time to bring it up and to use it as part of this appeal.
Exactly. However, the Sean Gearan, who appeared for the Director of Public Prosecutions, said that Dunsan isn't entitled to rely on that defence, that it just fell between the cracks, because that if it is a disadvantage, that was self-inflicted, because it was caused by what he says is a cynical and improper decision to sack his lawyers on the first day of his trial. And he reminded that Dunsan had sought an adjournment in his trial, but was refused after a Garda gave evidence that any delay would result in an increased risk of harm to April Collins. So he has described that as a cynical decision to sack his legal team.
Yeah.
It was presented at the time that if they allowed Dunsan another 6 months or a year to get a new defence team, that in the meantime, the guards are trying to protect April Collins living on that street. Mm. It is a fact already at that stage that she was under threat, and that, you know, it wouldn't be proper for that to be delayed. Mr. Gearan said there were 22 days between Dunsan hiring his second team of lawyers and the first of three witnesses giving evidence, and therefore there was time to consider all the material. And he also submitted that the phone call supported the prosecution case, not the defence case, in that it showed that the witnesses were in fear of John Dunsan.
Yeah. Just remind me, because when we talked at the beginning about covering that case, I think actually I probably covered more of Wayne Dunsan's trial than John Dunsan's trial. I think I might have been there for the verdict on John Dunsan. But what was he doing hunger striking before? Was he trying to delay this trial all the time while threats were being made and issued towards the state witnesses at that point, the Collins family and some of the McCarthys?
Well, if you remember, there's been a lot of a very elaborate kind of conspiracy theories have gone up around these trials. There was really extensive social media coverage of them, where bits of evidence was put out, bits of statements were put up, you know, claiming they were, I suppose, victims of this stitch-up by Gardaí. So all of that was going on. I think by the time it came around to the murder trials, John Dundon and his brother Wayne Dundon had already been prosecuted for threats against the Collins family. So that came in the aftermath of this already. And I think by that stage, you know, the Collins, April Collins, had been through court cases. She stood up to them. She performed well in the witness box. She was giving very direct evidence about the murder against John Dundon. And I think they had a sense that April Collins, while they'd thrown a lot at her, and they did during John Dundon's trial about her own, she'd come before the courts for very minor stuff herself, and also that she was motivated by it had been put to her that she was motivated by, you know, a hatred of the Dundons. She stood up very well in all of that. And even in, as John was convicted, she was, I wouldn't say she was praised by the judges, but they described her as being a credible witness. And that they've, you know, so I think he knew what was coming. And there was, like, obviously, like, you look back on it now and it's, you know, April Collins has survived and continued to live on Hyde Road. Yeah. And you know.
Which is extraordinary.
It has extraordinary, but at the time, it looked like a death sentence for her, do you know?
Yeah.
It looked like, because the Dundons had been involved in this really indiscriminate killings of a lot of people that really, like, obviously he'd been attempting to kill Pitchfork McNamara, who was a serious criminal in his own right, but they had killed people of a very, very minor nature for very, very minor stuff and used a kind of an extreme level of violence for very minor offences. So the idea that April Collins would survive and be okay, it didn't really seem realistic. And you can understand at the time then, you know, how any of that delay would allow all of this pressure to build on not just April Collins, but also on Christopher McCarthy, who, just given the fact that he is his first cousin, there's all sorts of inroads in to be had. You know, and looking back, it all makes sense. But at the time, I think we can see that there was people, once the Dundons were put behind bars and had gone through a certain amount of trials, even the people who had lived in fear of them, that fear kind of dropped away. And people were willing to stand up in court and give evidence against them rather than, because it was said, of course, during his trial that Christopher McCarthy and Lisa Collins could be considered an accomplice, which, you know, they accepted, but they went forward and gave evidence anyway.
It's hard to tell which of the two brothers, what's between Wayne and John as regards in the structure of the grouping or in the familial structure. They seem to be both almost joint heads of that family grouping.
Well, I think Wayne was always considered the kind of the more of the smarter one, actually. They are, I mean, they did used to be called the Dum Dum Brothers instead of the Dundon Brothers. But I think Wayne was probably a more, slightly more controlled. John Dundon was, you know, I would presume, a very, very, they were all very dangerous and hot-headed people. Wayne Dundon was no different. Wayne was probably considered more of the head in a way, but they were absolutely hand in glove at all times.
Between them age-wise as well, I think.
There's very little between them, and they seem to always act in concert, never, you know.
Don't they?
Yeah, not in a particularly, yeah, exactly. Always act in concert, and to a degree with the other two brothers as well, Desi and Jer. You know, they seem to have a very tight kind of situation.
A blood bond, obviously. But I mean, even within the prison system, when they have caused chaos within that, I think they've had to be almost split at times. But they bullied together. They instilled fear together. You know, there was never one without the other.
No, and obviously Desi Dundon, their other brother, had been in prison a long time, even when these cases had come to court. I mean, if he was a normal prisoner, he'd be approaching getting out. And some of the other people who were convicted with him at the time are getting to that point, which they'd be back on the streets. But Desi was always regarded as being a really, really ferocious and dangerous person as well, if much softer spoken. Mm-hmm. And we can obviously see Jair is being convicted again in the UK in relation to, you know, serious and organised crime. So an incredible level of convictions, murders, and chaos caused by really four brothers. You know, incredible stuff, really, when you think of it.
So the judges will gather to come up with their decision on that appeal over the coming months, and John Dundon will learn whether or not this is successful. It doesn't sound like there's much meat on the bone to me.
No, I mean, they've reserved judgment. I don't know if they've given a specific date when they're back. It doesn't seem like they have. So they'll give a very lengthy judgment on that. No doubt there was other bits of evidence as well. But no, it doesn't look like that. I mean, the fact that he did, you know, one of the appeals one of the grounds on which you could appeal is that you weren't advised properly or something like that. But that doesn't seem to be the case. And particularly, it seems to have been the fact that he did fire his own legal team. When you do fire your legal team like that, I've actually been in court when that has happened, but you get very serious warnings from the judge that this, and it has happened in other gangland cases over the years as well. And in each of those occasions, the judge have told the people very clearly that this can't be something that you do to your own advantage, that you have to take responsibility for it. It gets explained to you what the consequences are, that this can't be, you can't be using it as a cynical ploy. And then when it comes back on appeal, which a lot of these cases have, you don't get to rely on that. And that is made clear in advance. So I wouldn't be buying, if I was a John Dundon supporter, which I don't know if they're still out there, I wouldn't be buying a cake and waiting for him to get out.
Well, look, we'll wait and see. Anyway, thanks a million.
Thanks, Nicola.
You've been listening to Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. Produced by Ian Mullaney and edited by me, Nicola Tallant. Research assistant is Claude Amini. If you like this show and love true crime, leave us a review. Or why not download the free SundayWorld.com app for lots more stories from Ireland and across the globe.
Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.